So let me start with a story. I don't know where it came from. I don't really recollect where I first heard it. But it's a story that is stuck in my imagination, an oral history of sorts. It's of a young fellow visiting Switzerland in the late 1930s. And he was crossing the old Lake Zurich. There used to be a ferry service that probably still is, that crosses the lake from point to point. And he climbed aboard the old ferry boat and found himself there on a bench, surrounded by common folk, Swiss farmers, making their rounds. And as the boat sailed out across the lake, he looked up and noticed a most peculiar figure there, standing at the prow of the boat, was an old man, somewhat gray, a bit bent. His hair was in the wind, his eyes focused upon the deep water, his visage enwrapped in the smoke of an old Swiss pipe. The young fellow was captured by this vision. He couldn't take his eyes off him, there alone at the prow. An old farmer sitting next to him noticed where his eyes were cast, and after a while nudged him with an elbow and reached over and whispered in his ear, "Der, der ist unser Zaubermeister. There, there's our wizard." The fellow thought, and it made sense. There, there's our wizard. The man at the prow of the boat, of course, was C.G. Carl Gustav Jung. For almost four decades, I have, in my own metaphorical sense, been riding on that ferry myself. And I know that there are many here tonight who likewise have been sitting upon a bench, crossing a water, looking up at the prow, seeing the visage of this figure, this C.G. Jung. I first encountered him when I was, about 17. A friend gave me a book called Man and His Symbols, which I read. I still have my copy, a tattered paperback, deeply underlined. I must say, I understood perhaps little, or perhaps even none. But there were images in that book. There were words that captivated me. Symbol, self, individuation, transformation, archetype. And in my adolescent mind, they took some root, and there they sprouted. It was a few decades later that I again came across this name and began my own, shall we say, more intensive study of the man, Carl Gustav Jung, the old wizard at the prow of the boat. And that now is, regrettably, almost two decades ago. How time flies. But in those years, I've spent a great deal of time sitting on that bench, looking, wondering about the visage of that man. And Perhaps like you, at times my vision has turned more to my toes. My stomach has reeled. The fact of things is I get seasick easily. I find, shall we say, active waters rather disturbing in a deep and visceral sense. And I think we all have our malaise, our nausea with this life at times, which distracts us. And yet again and again across those years, I have glanced up and seen that man and wondered and sought to understand. So in this series of four meetings, four lectures over the next month, I invite you all to join with me. Walk up the plank. Take a seat on the bench of an old ferry and venture out upon deep and ancient waters. Look up. Take a look. See the old fellow there at the prow with that pipe. Eyes cast forward into the depths. Judge him as you will. That's your choice. But before you judge, look. Look. Carl Gustav Jung was born in the year 1875. He died on June the 6th of 1961. He is, I believe, to be judged by history as a signal figure of the 20th century. I believe he is and will so be judged by generations to come as a truly great man. But, oh, we live in the age of common women and common men, all of us together equal in our grand and vulgar commonness. There's no place on this leveled field of our modern expectation, really, for grandness, for greatness. We know our human heroes of lore as all too human, be they kings or presidents, warriors, prophets, priests, all too human. And the biographical appraisals of Jung manifest a singular difficulty with getting him. He's a shapeshifter. He's a hard one to put in the box. You know, the early evaluations of Jung were written mainly by his close, shall we say, disciples. That a man should have disciples alone says something of him. They were what might be called hagiographies, holy stories, holy biographies, saint biographies. Then there came evaluations of the man of a more negative nature, criticisms, critiques, belittlings. Colin Wilson wrote a book, biography, entitled it Lord of the Underworld. A fellow more recently by the name of Noel has written two extremely critical books, one called The Jung Cult, the other called The Aryan Christ, looking at this figure of Jung. And more recently, in fact, I think just last year, was published a huge biography, huge and detailed, very well-researched biography by a woman by the name of Deidre Baer, which I looked forward to reading with great anticipation and ended up finishing with great disappointment. It was and is, and you can go out to your bookstore and find it if you wish, although I don't advise it, a huge shopping bag full of puzzle pieces. But somehow it gave no clue to the puzzle. In like manner, evaluations of his huge corpus of work. I think Jung wrote almost 3 million words in his collected works, and I admit to having read at least 2/3 of them. In his large corpus of work, the evaluation of what he said, of what he taught, the whole gamut of things called Jungian psychology, are mired in conflicting perspectives. The rational perspective. Jungian psychology is a rational methodology, soundly founded in logical premises and established by practical therapeutic principles. Now, if you're a Jungian therapist, especially a Jungian therapist hoping to bill an insurance company, you would, by nature, embrace a rational methodology founded in logical premise. People don't pay shamans and mystics for medical care. But in perspective, in contrast, there's also, of course, the more mystical approach to this corpus of Jungian psychology. It is an enlightened and revitalized map of the psyche, appreciative of the word psyche's full transpersonal intentions, closely akin to the profound spiritual traditions of both East and West. And then a third perspective, commonly found, prominent in some recent literature, the occult and nefarious evaluation. Jungian psychology, and perhaps Jung the man himself, is a hodgepodge of highly idiosyncratic mysticism and obscurantism, rooted in a misguided 19th century German romanticism, and by its very Germanic nature, linked to the horrors of the Holocaust. Different ways of seeing this man, Jung. And I assure you that with narrowly focused vision, each of those positions can, and indeed has, been argued as the singular truth of Jung. But I suggest that to understand Carl Gustav Jung, to have any hope of understanding him, we simply must let our vision encompass a much, much, much larger vista of possibilities. Thankfully, Jung did leave us one autobiographical statement. The book was published under the name Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It was highly edited. The family itself of Jung, the surviving family after his death, because Jung stated that this autobiography would not be published until he was dead, was extremely concerned about the image that would be given to the world of this man. They were concerned about the legacy, I think perhaps more than the truth. And so the biography received some editing. But by the noble effort of its editors, the vast majority of the important statements of Jung are indeed preserved in that work. And I would advise you, if you would wish to seek one text for this course, even if you've read it a dozen times, go back and take one more look at that book. Because I think you'll come away from that book with the key to the puzzle, the key to the bag of pieces in that sack. And if there is perhaps a master picture that might help you in piecing that puzzle together, I suggest to you it is the image of a wizard. Wizard. Vide. Vide. Vis. Wissen. Wissen. Wisdom. Vide. Vid. Vis. Vedere. Vision. Vide. Vit. Git. Guide. Vide. Ved. Veda. There you have 3, 5, 7 millennia of the linguistic history of the word wizard. A history of Indo-European sounds, of the Indo-European tongue. The word wizard is rooted in a very ancient sound, vide. The linguistics of past centuries, in the 17th and 18th century, perhaps 18th and 19th century, better stated, came to realize, particularly in the confrontation with Sanskrit, that there were common roots in the languages of people scattered across a vast range of the Earth's geography, across the Asian subcontinent of India, Middle East, into Europe. And these words, seem to have a common source, common roots. Several hundred of these roots have been collected, and the evidence of their presence found in the various tongues passing from India to Wales, from north to south. And one of the key words, one of the words of power in this old language, was that word, vide. It meant, apparently, by all evidence of linguistic history, by its appearance in dozens of tongues, descendant of that original tongue, it meant to know. To know and also to see. To see and know. But the seeing and the knowing were not just of a material nature. In our world, we live once again on a rather single-visioned plane. Our vision is single-vision. We see what we see. What we with visual impression see outwardly. But in the root, in the source of our language, seeing had a duality. People saw outward. They saw also the unseen inward. In the Germanic tongues, vide, vis, wissen, to know. In the south of France, the tongues of Languedoc, a different transformation. Vibe became guide. To guide. How does one guide? Through the dark forest, on the unseen path. One knows the way. One sees. One has a vision. In Sanskrit, Vaid, Ved, Veda, Veda, knowledge. Perhaps in the Sanskrit, we have first evidences of what this Vaid, this Veda, this Vis was, what this knowledge was, what this vision was. The Vedic hymns took final form at least 1,000 years before Christ, 3 millennia ago. The Rig Veda, the corpus of Vedic hymns, gives us an image of what those ancient Indo-European fathers and mothers of ours meant with this word. Rig means a stanza. A stanza, a verse of praise. The Rig Veda, the stanzas of knowledge. Who were they written by? Legend says that they can be attributed to the vision, Vaid, of seers. Seers, Vaid. Or perhaps to an exhalation of divine breath. The creation hymn from the Rig Veda. Take it as an example. 3 millennia ago. The non-existent was not. The existent was not at that time. The atmosphere was not, nor the heavens, which are beyond. What was concealed? Where? In whose protection? Was it water? An unfathomable abyss. There was neither death nor immortality then. There was not distinction of day or night. That alone breathed, windless, by its own power. Other than that, there was not anything. Darkness was hidden by darkness in the beginning. All this was an indistinguishable sea. That which becomes, that which was enveloped by the void, that alone was born through the power of heat. Upon that desire arose in the beginning. This was the first discharge of thought. Sages discovered this link of the existent to the non-existent, having searched in the heart with wisdom. Their line of vision, their line of vision was extended across what was below, what was above. There were impregnators, there were powers, inherent power below, impulses above. Who knows truly? Knows Veda. Who here will declare whence it arose, whence this creation? The gods are subsequent to the creation of this. Who then knows whence it has come into being? Whence this creation has come into being, whether it was made or not? He is the highest heaven. He in highest heaven is its surveyor. Surely he knows. Or perhaps he knows not. The Rig Veda. Vision. Vaid, formed. My own Welsh fathers, in their shared Celtic heritage, also shared this old Indo-European word. And understand, I'm not speaking just of linguistics here, because what is a word? A breath of divine thought, a breath of human experience. And when the word speaks of something more than the exterior, but the interior, we should know, we should understand. it as an evidence of human life's experience of itself. We experience both seen and unseen worlds. And so those old Celtic forefathers had their own use of this word. Vide. Vit. Vit was a seer. Dru. Vit. A word in Latin interpreted by the Romans as druid. Druvit. Deru, another old Indo-European word. It meant strong, steadfast. The druvit was the steadfast seer, the knowing one. Likened to the ancient sacred oak head raised up into the skies, roots sinking to unimaginable depths of the earth, enduring longer than the memory of any single generation of women and men. We know little or nothing about these druids, but perhaps in the divine breath of the Rig Veda, we can catch an image of what it was that their seers saw. We can catch perhaps a common experiential thread of vision. Vision. We, of course, recognize that shamans appear in almost all primitive cultures. And, of course, we also realize that one of the signal characteristics of a developed culture, such as our own, as well, we know there are no such thing as shamans, wizards. Oh, we have scientists, philosophers, primitive people. That they have shamans, medicine men. They believe in wizards. Mircea Eliade, the great and late Romanian mythologist and once professor at the University of Chicago, wrote a key work called Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. And in this tour de force, he investigated the primitive experience of the shaman, the reality, the history of shamanism. It appears that in ancient primitive cultures, these individuals were seen as connected to forces, seen and unseen, light and dark, above and below. They were the center pole that connected dual realities. Through them, others could find connection and guidance and help on their own earthly journey. Shamans were, in the study of Eliade, of Central Asian shamanism, called in two fashions. They were often hereditary shamans. They were children of a lineage. But it was also recognized that occasionally a being, an individual, would be spontaneously called to the path of shaman. Eliade summarizes the path of initiation as shaman, as including a period of what might be called an illness, a creative illness, a period of descent into the nether unseen worlds. After this illness, this calling, shall we say, this descent, there was usually a period of initiation into techniques of shamanism. techniques, archaic techniques, he calls them, of ecstasy. Ekstasis, the Greek word, standing outside of oneself, mad. That's what an ecstasy was, a madness. It was also seen in later Greek literature as a leaving of the soul from the body, a stepping out. But, the wizard is not a shaman. The word wizard enters our language in the Middle Ages. Our specific English language adopts the word in the late Middle Ages. And when the wizard appears by that name in our history, he appears with a highly differentiated character. He is a reflection, perhaps a perfect mirror image of a thousand-year-long process of differentiation in the Western consciousness. If we were to look back across two millennia to the undoing of shamanism in the West, we might see the beginning of that end in Christianity itself. In the birth and development of the Western Christian vision, our eyes turned to a very distinct discrimination of opposites. The shaman was the center pole, connecting above and below. And there was, in essence, no judgment about above being good and below being evil. The above and the below were organically connected, intertwined, mated. Their unification, the touching of the two, was the magic, the vision. But in our Christian consciousness, in the birth and development of Christianity, above and below gained very specific qualitative evaluation. Above, good, light, bright. Below, dark, sensual, devilish. A light, a word, had come from above and had entered into human flesh to enlighten it, to awaken it to what it was. And over the first 1,000 years of the Christian aeon, that knowing was increasingly linked to the rational, awakened, conscious light of humankind. The flesh, the tissue, shall we say the earth in which the roots of an ancient oak once sank for sustenance, that nether realm was of the devil, dark, sinful flesh. And its instincts, well, they led along the road to damnation. The light word, the conscious realization, was honored. And by the Middle Ages, was intensely wed to a type of almost insanely sterile rationalism, evidenced in the scholasticism of the Middle Ages, perhaps the ultimate manifestation of which was Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologica, the summation of theology, an Aristotelian proof of God, of the Christian God. It was into this world of the Middle Ages, this world. It was at this moment that the first of the race we call wizards entered Middle Earth, or perhaps better stated, the Middle Ages. His name was Merlin. Now, this figure, Merlin Wilt, he dwells at the boundaries of history. You can find evidences of his name in historical legend, going back across the very threshold of what history has record of in the 4th and 5th century in the old Celtic lands of Wales, in the Isles, the Fairy Isles of Britain. But to seek Merlin in history is to totally miss the point. Merlin was not born in history. Merlin was born in the medieval imagination. Something quite extraordinary happened then, 1,000 years ago. There was a real turning of consciousness in the medieval period. It was the beginning of us as modern humans, us as modern women, modern men. The word romance had meant, up until that period of the 12th century, 13th century, and it had meant an historical collection of tales, histories. And if you read the literature prior to that period, it was essentially just that, a statement of fact after fact. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. Of course, most of what they said happened hadn't happened, as best we can tell, but it was stated to have happened, but without any psychological motivation. In the Middle Ages, the word romance changes. All of a sudden, what we understand as romance finds a deep concern with psychological motivation. What was going on? Why did it happen? What was she thinking? What was he thinking? These are the elements of what we consider character development, what we expect in a creative effort, a novel, a movie. Well, maybe we don't expect it. Maybe at Christmas time we expect lots of explosions and car races and very little motivation and a whole lot of action. There is that genre still that attracts people. But, I won't speak too badly of it. There are moments when you do want to see things blowing up. I've felt that way. I've felt that way on many a day. But in the romance of the Middle Ages, there entered this more psychological element of character motivation. And the texts turned in a most amazing way to a couple of most mysterious themes. Love. The relationship of human man and human woman. And the quest. The seeking of a magical element of transformative power. Both of these literatures, a love literature, a grail literature, were also deeply related to this evolution, this awakening of the soul, the psychological motivation, what was going on inside, related to what was going on the outside. One cannot bring the literature, the Grail legends of this period into one single corpus. They erupted from the imagination of the time. There is a series of stories, and they don't all tell the same story. They each have a different vision. They each take a different storyline. Characters are the same, words are the same, names the same, oh, with modifications. Plots, similar themes, but a great deal of difference. One of the principal authors of this period was a fellow by the name of Robert de Boron, a French poet, writing around the year 1200, perhaps a little after. And he wrote three great poems on the history of the Grail, on Merlin, and on Lancelot. Now, the name of Merlin had appeared earlier, of course. It had appeared in the history of Gregory of Monmouth 100 years before. But it was in this period that the story of Merlin really began to develop. And although there are many takes on the man, if he be a man, but I will perhaps tonight concentrate on this particular story, poem, told by Robert de Boron. Unfortunately, his poem itself survives to us in this day only as a few tiny fragments. But the poem was widely circulated and found a prose recension, a prose edition. And the text to which I'll turn tonight in talking about Dear Merlin is the what is known as the Prose Merlin, which took form in the late Middle English. The story of Merlin, the first wizard of Western culture. The story starts with his birth. So let me turn just a little bit to the Middle English text and give you a faint taste of what it sounded like in the hall of a bard across the mists of time. Full wroth and angry was the devil that our Lord had been in hell and had out taken Adam and Eve and others at his pleasure. And when the fiends seen that, they had right great fear and great marvel. They assembled them together and said, "What is he this thus us surpriseth and destroyeth, insomuch that our strength nay naught else that we have may not withhold him, nor again him stand? He this hath destroyed that which we would should have be most avail." The fiends are in hell. Oh, I should add something else. The word hell, Hades, Vide. In Greek, they dropped the W. Ibe, idea. And Aedes, the seen, unseen world. Our hell itself is related to that word wizard in strange, strange ways. Well, you see, the demons are in hell. And there's been a problem. Into the earth there has come this God-man, born of a virgin. All good and light and bright. Well, the devils don't have any real difficulty with this. I mean, devils are devils. And angels and angels, well, you know, they're brothers and sisters. They've been around for a while. They have their kingdoms. Above, below, okay. The problem is that this fellow had the audacity to come down and harrow hell. This is an old legend of Christ, important in the Middle Ages. In fact, the medieval monks used to perform a little ceremony of the heroine of hell. Because after Christ's death upon the cross, where does he go? He goes into the underworld. And what does he do? He liberates the spirits, the souls that are there. Adam and Eve, they say. And many others that suit his pleasure. He invaded their kingdom. How dare he? And took what was theirs, the dead souls. Well, they were pissed, these demons. And so, the prose Marilyn, the poem of Robert de Brown, tells us that they had made a plot. They were going to fix this up just right. And one of the devils, he said, I can get upon a mortal woman. I can make one too, you know. So the devils decide that they will send a demon to earth. And he's going to find himself a worthy virgin. And he's going to have a child. But the father of this one, well, it's only symmetry, you know. They've got a light one, now we've got a dark one. And the two then shall contend, equal to equal. A discrimination of opposites, we might say, in Jungian psychological terms. A duality. And so the demons plot. They find a worthy maiden. And they see that they have to find a way to get her, to make her open herself up to a psychological state where the demon can have her. Get upon her, as they said.